All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck nicks? What the fuckocrats? What's going on? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. I'm a little amped. Got a lot of clarity. Got a lack of filter. A lot of things going on in my mind. Not so much around me in the real world, but I'm grateful for that. Things not going on is fine, considering that bad things could be going on and are going on every day, all around the world, not for me today. I'm grateful for that. I will say this, in terms of what's happening and what you can do to help the folks on the ground in Houston and Louisiana, a lot of people are wondering how to donate to the relief effort. Here are a few suggestions just to keep in mind. Make sure you do your own research on the groups you're giving to. Know where the money you send is going and what it's being used for, and make sure it's being used for the relief effort. With that in mind, local groups are often the best option because they're working directly on the relief effort from the ground right there. We use Charity Navigator to do research on charities, but there are other helpful research sites out there like GiveWell and Charity Watch. We've made donations here at the show to the Houston Food Bank and the Houston SPCA. Both are rated the highest possible 4 stars on Charity Navigator, and their volunteers have been working around the clock on this relief effort. They're doing great work, and they need all the support they can get. But like I said, people, do your own research. It won't take long. Those research sites make it very easy, and give what you can to the places that you think will help, but try to give. These are times for giving. People are in trouble all over the world. That's just some information I thought I'd share with you. Today on the show, Steve Jordan is here. Steve Jordan, the amazing drummer from the original Letterman show, from SNL, from many records, the Expensive Winos with Keith Richards. He's drummed with Neil Young. He's drummed with everybody. Neil Young, everyone. He's got his own label now. He's got a new album coming out. It's out now, actually. It's called Garage Sale by his band, The Verbs. He also produced the latest Robert Cray record. Remember Robert Cray? Robert Cray was great and is great still. The album is called Robert Cray and High Rhythm. It's produced by Mr. Jordan. He's also got, Steve's got a show on the Sirius. He's got a show on the Sirius XM channel 106. Called Laying It Down with Steve Jordan. I was excited to talk to him because he was one of those guys that was sort of the backbeat of my childhood in a way, or at least since I started watching David Letterman in college. And I always liked him. I always thought he was a great drummer, and I was always excited to get an album that he was playing on. Played with Keith a lot, so we talk about Keith. We talk about the Stones, talk about Cray, talk about jazz. It's a good talk all around, and he's a good cat. I like music, guys. I learned some things about the drums. Another thing I wanted to say in a more self-promoting way is that my new comedy special, Too Real, is what it's called, premieres on Netflix next Tuesday, September 5th. So go ahead and add that to your queue, and it will be there for you to watch when it's streaming next week. I talked to a couple people about it who watched it. I haven't watched it, I watched it when we edited, but since then I haven't really sat down and taken it in, and I was very happy that the two guys that were, doing pieces on me about it seemed to be very into it. I'm very happy with it. I'm good with it. It came together well. Some of the jokes that I thought, might not be as relevant now are actually more relevant, which is exciting. And I'm proud of it, so I hope you watch that. It's Mark Maron, me. Show's called, the special's called Too Real on Netflix. Netflix? No, Netflix. On Tuesday, I think. It's September 5th. It's a Tuesday, right? All right? Okay. So what's happening with you people? Where was I last time? Quitting nicotine? I'm still quitted. I am still quitted. I'm off. Now it'll be, by the time you listen to this, unless I fucking break down today, let's see, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, tomorrow will be 5 days. So Thursday, when you're listening to this, I'll be 5 days off the nick. And it's a little better than when I talked to you on Monday. It's a tough thing to, the habit of it is tough. You know, I deal, like, whenever I have to come out here, whenever I have to talk to somebody, I'm like, I need things. I need a thing. I need the thing. And I wander around. But unfortunately, I've been eating a lot. I'm trying to eat healthily. But I got to do something. And I'm trying not to justify it or rationalize it. I got to assume that it's good not to be eating, you know, 8 to 12 nicotine lozenges a day to the point where I'm sick and my eyes are crossing by the end of the day. I have to assume that I'm giving some of my organ system a rest. I got to assume that my kidneys are relieved, my pancreas is relieved, my stomach is relieved, things are relieved. The caffeine, I'm drinking tea, which is caffeinated, but I'm off the coffee, so I don't get that craving to match it. So, yeah, every time you drink coffee, the caffeine wants to be matched. It wants to be matched by nicotine and vice versa. You do some nicotine, it demands a match with caffeine. It's just the way it works, man. It's the way it works for me. I don't know who you are or what your life is, but that's the way it works over here. I'm going to lay off getting all worked up about the world today, if you don't mind. Because of the nicotine withdrawal and because I'm kind of floating, I don't seem to know what day it is or what time it is. I'm not as thorough in checking in. I'm feeling very in the moment when I'm driving because I'm withdrawing. You know, I'm taking unnecessary risks behind the wheel, not looking for thrills just because I'm so in the present. I think I got the timing aced. Everything's aced. When you're fucking amped up and your body's withdrawing and your whole being is craving for the outside world to make things right, you're checked in, man. You are tapped in. You are hooked up with the timing of reality. So there's that moment of slow motion where, you know, I'm changing lanes, I'm making left turns, I'm doing shit where I'm like, I don't even think, like, can I make it? I just think I'm making it. And hopefully that doesn't backfire. But right now, I'm enjoying the zen. You dig? All right. Whew, boy. Yeah, a little disjointed with the nicotine. I'm also on Flonase. I've been having some sinus congestion. I hope that's what it is and not a tumor behind my face. Let's get on with it. Steve Jordan is here. He's a great drummer. And as I said, he's got a show on Sirius XM, Channel 106, called Laying It Down with Steve Jordan. He's got the new album with his band, The Verbs, called Garage Sale. He's produced Robert Cray's new record, High Rhythm. That's out. But this was a blast. This is a really fun conversation. Me and Steve Jordan, the drummer. Nice to see you, Steve.
Good to see you.
Yeah, you're familiar to me from way back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember there was a dreadlock period.
Absolutely. I was the first person to wear dreadlocks on network television every day.
On the Letterman show?
That's right.
You were the first drummer for Letterman.
I was the first drummer and co-founder of the world's most dangerous band.
With Paul.
The band was actually a band called the 24th Street Band. We had a band. It was Will Lee, Hiram Bullock, Clifford Carter, and myself.
Yeah.
And when Paul was looking to put together a band for the show, he came to me first, and then I suggested, why don't we just get Will and Hiram, because we're already a band.
Right.
So that's why we were so tight when we started.
Oh, that's how it worked?
From day one.
Yeah.
And we rehearsed in my home.
Where?
On Fifth Avenue.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, in Manhattan. I have a loft. And,
yeah.
And,
you still have it?
Yes, we still have it. That's right. You know, when you get a deal like that in Manhattan, you keep it.
Don't give it up.
Yeah, exactly. And we started rocking.
Yeah. So, like, I remember seeing you, and I remember, you know, Dave always integrated the band into the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
He always talked to Paul, who, like, over time developed a weird stilted timing that you didn't know. It was always the assumption that he was high.
Right.
But you know, I think it's just after talking to him, I think it's just the way he is.
Yeah. Timing. But, timing's everything.
Yeah, huh? Yeah. And his is a little off.
Well, he's not a drummer.
No.
Most good comedians are drummers.
in their hearts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm a guitar player.
Yeah, well, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And, but yeah, no, you got to know where the beats are. Yeah.
Exactly.
But it's a different instrument.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been, you know, getting, you know who I ran into at the airport? Like, it's taken me years to appreciate music in a deeper way. Like I had this, I ran into Daryl. Daryl Jones.
Oh, yeah, my man.
Yeah, at the airport. And he recognized me, and we were going to London, and he was going to record, and we just sat down and talked for an hour about you know, rhythm sections.
He's a sweetheart.
He's a great guy.
He's a great guy.
I didn't know he started with Miles. Why would I know that?
Oh.
That's one of those things that I wouldn't know, and now I know it. Now I got to go look for shit.
Oh, totally. He's played with everyone. Are you kidding?
So have you.
Well, yeah, but he, yeah.
Yeah, and you played together with him too, right?
Absolutely.
Recently.
And in fact, you know, I like to think that, you know, that I was, you know, I played kind of an instrumental, no pun intended, role in getting him.
Into the Stones?
Yeah.
Getting him that sweet gig?
Yeah, yeah.
Filling in for Bill?
Yeah.
I brought that up with Keith Richards. Like, he got mad at me too.
Not hard to do. when it comes to him getting mad.
Not really mad, but I said, like, yeah. I told him, I said, you know, I haven't seen the Stones live in a long time, and I was resistant because, you know, Bill doesn't play with the Eddie board. And he's like, Bill hasn't played with us in 20 years, 25 years.
Yeah, exactly.
And Daryl was a bass player. He had nothing personal against Bill, but it's like the bass player that's our bass player.
Daryl and I both are kind of shocked that it's been that long. You know, the time has flown. It seems like he just joined the band yesterday. Same thing with Ron Wood. I mean, Ronnie is, you know, not an original member, but he's been in there for like 30-something years. And it's just like, almost like, he just left Rod Stewart and he's like, he just joined this. No.
Yeah.
You know, that was 30-something years
ago.
It
was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But the conversation, and Keith is a good place to go with it, was that, like, I guess I never understood, you know, as deeply as I do now from listening more intently over the last decade, just, you know, how important, and obviously you're going to think this is ridiculous, that the rhythm section is the whole band. And it's, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's all of it.
Absolutely.
I listened to a reissue of Get Your Ya-Ya's Out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm listening to Charlie and Bill, and I'm like, holy shit, if they didn't keep this together, it would be a disaster. Like, it would be a disaster. And and Keith talks about that, too, in terms of Charlie.
Well, first of all, his love for Charlie is really, really deep.
Yeah.
And they have a connection that, you know, that is a bond that's unbreakable. That's the first thing. But one item of note is that Keith is a great bass player.
Is he?
So he played bass on Street
Exile.
Fighting Man.
Yeah.
And he played bass on, you know.
A lot of Exile, I think.
You know, Jumpin' Jack Flash, you know, all that, you know, a lot of great bass playing was done by Keith. And Ron Wood is a great bass player, too. So they know what the bass is, the function of the bass.
Right.
And some of their most kind of rockin'est tracks were done with basically like Keith and Charlie, you know, alone, and then they built off of stuff.
Really?
You know? Yeah. So Keith, I don't think people realize the magnitude of his brilliance, you know, studio.
It's so simple. What was awesome to me was when I saw them, I went and saw them in the last tour at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Is that they don't use any fucking backtracks. You know, they're just up there playing, and it's very simple stuff, but it's the Stones. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. There's, you know, the band has a chemistry. Most great bands have amazing chemistry.
But you've built stuff from the ground up with him. Tell me more about why he's misunderstood.
I think that, simplicity is sometimes mistaken for stupidity or whatever.
Right.
You know, people, they're afraid to or they don't understand that less is more.
Right. Space.
And the space in the music is just as important as what you're playing. That's all part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't you take a canvas. You don't fill up the canvas with a bunch of paint.
Right.
You know, you paint a picture.
Right.
You're playing the song. He plays the song. And of course, being such a great writer, he writes the song.
Right.
So the music is there.
Yeah.
And you don't just fill in the space for the sake of filling in space. You know, like, you know, the word tacit is very important.
Yeah.
In syncopation.
Right.
You know, that's the whole thing. The push and pull of rock and roll.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And you have that in, obviously, in jazz and blues, it's the same thing. You don't fill in every space.
No, you want to hold back.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And breathing is very important. It's the same thing in symphonic music.
Mm-hmm.
When there's a space, there's a space for a reason.
Yeah.
So that when you do play something, it means something.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And that's the same thing for drummers who play too many fills. You know what? Well, so that means that nothing you're playing really counts, really matters, because you're playing too much.
Right.
But when you play something, when you don't play a lot, and you're just holding the groove down, and then when you do play that, whoa, that must have been, that means something.
Wow. And it stands out.
Right.
Well, I mean, I want to talk to you about working with Chuck and Keith, because Chuck's another guy where, you know, that rhythm is a little like, it's tricky. Like the way he, you know, runs, you know, where he, the way he hits that guitar.
Absolutely. Well, he developed a style.
Yeah.
He invented something.
Yeah, but that bounce. Yeah,
well,
I mean,
on a musical description of that is, you know, and this is where jazz comes into play.
Yeah.
In the kind of development of rock and roll.
Right.
So you have two of the main architects of rock and roll are Chuck Berry and Little Richard.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they were playing, and at the risk of sounding too technical, they were playing like eighth notes, straight eighth note. Right?
Yeah.
So either Chuck is playing that on guitar, or Little Richard on the piano, which is basically kind of a boogie woogie type of thing, you know, coming from what, Fats Waller, you know, those guys, right? Now, the drummers that were part of the development of this style, rock, here's where the role comes in.
Right.
They were playing what essentially is jazz against a straight eighth. They were playing what you call a dotted eighth note.
Yeah.
Ding, did, did, ding, did, did, ding, did, did, ding.
Yeah.
So now you have ding, 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 ding. And that's the push and pull.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's not just everybody going da 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 da.
Right.
You know, it's not like, you know, a German marching band.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Like, no, it's swinging and it's doing that thing. That's where the drums come in. So like Earl Palmer, who developed that thing with Little Richard. He was the drummer on all that Little Richard stuff.
Yeah.
Most of it, not all of it. But all he ever wanted to be was Max Roach. Same thing with Charlie Watts.
Yeah.
They love Max Roach. They love Elvin Jones. They love, you know. And so they were playing jazz against. Ding, 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 ding. Same thing with Fred Bilo, who played it at Chess, who was the drummer who played
with Chuck and
with
Muddy
Chuck Berry and Muddy Waters, and you know, and then that. So his drumming with Willie Dixon on bass. Willie Dixon is walking, boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
He's walking. He's jazz. He's playing jazz.
Yeah,
he's
doing
right. And so that's where that is. So that's what happened. That's the development of this new style born in America.
It's got to
rock and roll. That's the roll against the rock.
It's got to swing, though.
It's got to swing.
Yeah, you know, some drummers can't do it.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, and that's how you get the generic bar band sounding, the people who can't swing.
They're staying right on top of it,
they
right?
They just go, that, you know, everything is squared off.
Right.
You see? And, and that's the thing. That is the that's the secret sauce.
The swing.
Yeah.
You got to be able to do it. Either you have it or you don't.
Exactly.
But like, you know, mentioning all these guys, where did you get educated? I mean, how did you come up? Where did you start?
I was very, very fortunate. I grew up in New York City.
You did.
And in New York City, the New York City Board of Education was a tremendous source of inspiration when it came to developing children in the arts.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously the arts have been under assault for the last 40 years in regards to public education. I went to a public school, And
which one? Did you go to the Fame School?
Well, actually, I went to Music and Art High School, which is actually the Fame School is Performing Arts.
Okay.
The Performing Arts is our annex.
Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah. You were the original?
Fiorello H. LaGuardia High School of Music and Art.
Yeah.
Was the main school.
Yeah.
And it was right in the middle of City College in Harlem on 135th Street and Convent Avenue. But before we even got there, when you were in elementary school, you were, the first day of school, you were given a musical instrument to take home, and you were assigned an instrument, either it was a violin or a clarinet or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's all part of developing a full human being.
Oh, absolutely. And you were given drums?
I wasn't given drums. I ended up playing in the percussion section. The first thing I started playing was actually the concert bass drum. Then I graduated to timpani. And the timpani is really so, you know, my upbringing in symphonic music is really where I get developed a discipline.
Yeah, right, right. That's an important point, that you know, to engage in a musical instrument is part of a well-rounded person in a
absolutely
lot of ways.
So either that or you were an art student or something, but that was part of the arts.
Yeah,
being a creative person is part of development of the total psyche of a human, and you know, unfortunately that's been under assault in the last 40 years and 30 years.
And also,
years.
You know, dismissed or just not found interesting. I mean, I at some level, I guess, you know, music's not for everybody, but creativity and engaging your imagination and learning how to express yourself is certainly important. And yeah, there does seem to be a shortage, whether it's funding or not.
Yeah, well, it's been taken, not even taken for granted. It hasn't been really completely acknowledged by a certain group of people who like to
cut the budget. Yeah,
you know.
They see it as a waste.
Yeah, exactly. I put it this way. I am a friend of mine took me to an MSNBC party several years ago.
Yeah,
and I'm at this party and I'm talking to Andrea Mitchell, and then she turns and she says, "Oh, meet." You know, so-and-so, and it's Alan Greenspan.
Right.
You know,
Fed.
I had no idea that they were actually a couple at the time. It was like this, you know, I had no idea.
Right.
But the point is here is that, you know, he's a clarinet player.
Yeah.
You know, this is the guy who's, you know, telling everybody where the money is.
Yeah.
And he plays clarinet, you know, and I said, you know, you want to make a record? You know, I mean, but the thing is, he's all of these people that I met, they were all like musicians. They all either played an instrument or they can't wait to work is over until they can run to and they have their own little bands and all kinds of stuff.
Sure.
And here's a guy who all he wanted to be was Woody Herman, you know, or whatever, you know.
And
he figured out what to do, and now he's the smartest guy when it comes to money. But that's all part of the thing. In fact, when I started reading music, I became a better math student.
Timing because
you have to read. It's all numbers. Yeah. And my mother was very frustrated with my math skills at first. And then I started reading music and I became a good reader and then my math got better. So they're all there. It's all connected.
But when you're coming up, so you go to high school at the...
So Music and Art High School, I auditioned for the school and I got in.
And who, like, you know, at that point, you're playing timpani in an orchestra?
Timpani and concert snare drum.
But no set. You don't have a set.
I didn't get a set until right before I auditioned for school. And I never got a full set right away. In fact, this is how...
What was missing?
Well, this is how I acquired a kit.
Yeah.
When I started taking formal lessons when I was 8 years old, my grandmother and she said, "Okay, we'll buy you a snare drum." It was $25 at that time. That was a lot of money. $25 for a Japanese snare drum, Zimgar, gold sparkle snare drum, and it was like they weren't going to get me a drum unless I promised to take lessons. And I be serious.
Yeah.
So I got it. So basically, I was given a piece at a time.
Yeah.
I didn't get a whole kit, you know, it was like that kind of thing. Uh-huh. And I think that really It was very astute, actually, that whole concept, you know, like the carrot.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, if you really want it, then you'll keep working, and then we'll get you.
And,
yeah.
And you're listening to music saying, like, well, I can't play that
right
until I get that.
But it's all in my head.
Yeah, I need a hi-hat.
Yeah, I didn't get the hi-hat was one of the last things I got.
Oh, my God.
And the funny story about that is that I got a hi-hat, and one of the first records I started playing to was Sly and the Family Stone's, like, Everybody is a Star and that kind of thing. And later on in life, I become friends, very good friends with Greg Errico, the original drummer.
Uh-huh.
And he lent me his hi-hat cymbals. They're the same hi-hat cymbals that I practiced to. Now I have the cymbals. I actually own the cymbals.
They're yours?
Yeah. Yeah. Is that nutty or what?
It's great.
That's crazy.
Those are magical items.
Absolutely.
And when you get into, you know, the big time into high school, I mean, who are your, you know, teachers? Who's influencing you? Is it, you know, coming out of symphony? I mean, do you gravitate towards jazz? Are you listening to Art Blakey and those guys?
The first thing I ever learned on the drums was Art Blakey's Blues March, Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, written by the great Benny Golson.
Yeah.
And my dad, who's an architect, engineer kind of cat, he said to me, if you learn how to play Blues March, you'll be able to play anything. And that was, once again, another very astute comment, because it not only did it swing, but it had all the hands, you know, and so developed dexterity. And then there was a solo in it. And, you know, if you learn the solo, you get your not only your type of improvisation chops together, but you know, you listen, so you get your memory together.
Yeah.
You know, the memory thing is very important in music as well. When you're playing symphonic music and you're playing the timpani, you learn the music, because you don't want to, you're not going to count 500 bars until you come in. You play like, you know, you play a total of like four measures the whole freaking piece. You're not going to, you know, you better learn the music, because if you miss counting one bar, you come in the wrong bar, you're screwed, right?
You don't want to fuck up your four beats.
Exactly, exactly. So you learn the
music. Bum, bum, bum.
Exactly. Oh, no.
Fuck that up.
Exactly, you know. You know, the whole orchestra turns around and looks at you.
Idiot.
You freaking nut.
You're two notes.
You're two notes. You blew that, yeah.
But so did you grow any sort of affinity for classical music?
Yeah, I love Mozart.
And you understand it?
I do. And I'm very fortunate.
Because I can listen to it, but not unlike jazz. You know, like, I would have to go to, you know, I think music is always accessible in that, you know, either you got a brain that takes it in and says, right, like, I can do this. You know, some music, you know, like, I don't like this, whatever. But, you know, to really understand classical, I think that's sort of, it takes a little research.
Well, it's kind of very, it depends on what the definition of understand, really.
I guess so,
you
yeah.
know what I mean?
Right.
So, I mean, it's not like a lot of people understand jazz when they're listening to it either. But they know that they like it, whether it's a beat or whether it's the freedom of the improvisation.
Right, right.
But it's very much based on symphonic music, a lot of jazz.
Is it?
Yeah, because, you know, you have to learn.
You mean, you know, like when big band
playing,
jazz?
When you're playing through, if you're a soloing,
yeah.
If you're the art of improvisation, whether it's playing through chord changes,
yeah.
You have to have that kind of knowledge that you would have if you were a classical musician, because you know, you have to know, you know, obviously
when
a large,
it's coming.
Well, yeah, you have to know what chords do.
Yeah.
And what notes are in those chords.
Yeah, but like also, but with blues, you know, you're talking about three chords, maybe four.
Right, right, if you're lucky.
If you want to make it a soul song,
yeah.
You throw that other one in. The minor.
Right. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
And then, you know, you kind of know when those are coming. Is it right. 8 or 12 or what?
Right.
But like with jazz, like even something that Paul Schaefer said in here, that Miles said to him, like he had one experience with Miles where they talked, and I guess Miles said, you know, don't play the bass. Don't play the root.
Right.
Don't play the root, play
right.
around it.
Right.
And that, you know, to Paul was like, oh.
Right.
You know, like,
sure.
I don't know what that means exactly, but I kind of get it.
Right. Well,
you know,
yeah,
and but that seems to be not necessarily, you know, symphonic knowledge, but kind of blues knowledge, you know, or maybe not. Maybe that's jazz knowledge. I don't know.
That's a combination. It's a combination of all of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you're taking lessons, do you take lessons at in high school from any dudes that were like real dudes?
Yeah. In fact, and here again, another amazing thing.
And did you master that Art Blakey thing?
I did.
And how old were you?
I was about, I got it down like when I was about 10.
10?
Yeah.
And you, what, you spend a year on it?
Well, you know, off and on, you know, just getting into, well, see, because I'm growing up, I got Ringo in one ear, I got Tony Williams in the other ear, I got Benny Benjamin, Al Jackson, you know, Clyde Stubblefield. I'm listening to all music because music was prevalent in the household.
Mm.
My dad's favorite trumpet player was Clifford Brown. Then he was killed in a tragic car accident. So then he switched his allegiance to Miles. So there was Miles Davis playing.
I'm a newly baptized Lee Morgan guy.
Okay, so my first. Okay, so one day I'm going to my first visit to Music and Art High School.
Yeah,
and it's in Harlem, as I said earlier. It's on 135th Street and Convent Avenue. My grandmother lived on 156th and St. Nicholas. And so my dad, who worked in the municipal building downtown, he said, look, after you go to school, go to your grandmother's house. There's a jazz mobile on 155th Street, and we'll go check out the jazz mobile concert that night. It'll be Dizzy Gillespie's big band.
Yeah.
And what the Jazzmobile was, a foundation that taught jazz to kids in schools and obviously a great educational program. And they would do block parties.
Yeah.
You know, block up the street, and they'd have free concerts. So I go to my grandmother's house. Earlier that day, I go and I have my first experience at Music and Art, and I was told to come there because the jazz band, they had a jazz band, and rumor had it that the drummer who was in the jazz band the term before was moving out of New York, down south, and maybe if I came, I would have a shot of possibly getting in or at least auditioning. So I get there, and the conductor is this cat. I've never seen a guy that looked like this before. He's a really cool looking dude. He had kind of like hexagon sunglasses, yeah. a crisp white shirt with blue bell bottoms with bold white stripes and brown kind of Florsheim Chelsea boot kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like wild looking cat. You know, I'm like, wow, is this like, this is going to be like, this is a teacher? Wow, this is amazing. Music and Art, this is already the most incredible thing experience I've ever had. And it's like, I don't even know anything yet. I mean, so I have this guy in my head, and I'm like, wow, this is wild. So I'm telling my grandmother and everything. So then we go, my dad gets to her house, and he takes me around the block, and we go see Dizzy's big band.
Yeah.
And I'm always going right up to the front. I want to see who's playing what or whatever. And
how
I don't really know
it.
Anything, but I'm trying to. And I look up at the trumpet section, and I turn to my father. I said, Dad, that's my teacher. That's my teacher. I met him today. It was Lee Morgan.
No shit. Wow. So you played in a band conducted by Lee Morgan?
He was killed that summer, actually.
Yeah. So what was that,
Slugs.
Like 70?
Slugs.
What was that? What year? 60-something?
No, it was
72 or 3.
Yeah. 71, 72.
Yeah.
So I did get a chance to, you know, Lee Morgan.
Wow.
And, you know, in that band, that was the first time I saw the great Mickey Roker, who just passed away 2 weeks ago. Incredible drummer and an inspiration. And so that's New York.
Yeah.
You know, so... you know, that's the whole experience. All the players that were at Music and Art High School, a lot of them have gone on
to
really big things.
Well, I like the idea that, like, you know, to commit to a piece when you're young and say, like, I gotta do this, I gotta learn this, Is that like, because I always used to believe for years, but you know, I'm just an, you know, I just play, I'm not a professional musician, that in order to understand the blues, if you can't make Rolling and Tumbling your own,
right, sure, yeah,
like whatever that is,
right,
you know, you can't play it like Muddy did or whatever, though that's a beautiful slide, but that somehow that song was a portal,
mm-hmm,
in my mind,
totally,
to understanding it, so
right.
For and I think Keith did it with Jimmy Reed and Chuck.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
Is like, I'm going to do this right. It's not going to sound like him, even though you may think it does or whatever. But the more important thing is to own it.
Yeah, own it and try to understand it. Try to get into the mindset. You know, a lot of my favorite players, and especially when I got to see them play, because that's another great thing about New York.
Yeah.
You could actually go and see these legends all the time.
It's crazy.
And then you get into like, well, how are they feeling? Okay, now not just listening to them, I can actually see them as well. That's incredible. And then you start mimicking them, whatever,
right,
you know,
right.
takes to
Little
get
moves.
To, until you get to where you're going.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
And another great experience about being in New York. You know?
Yeah,
you know?
And like with drums, like because it's not my instrument, I don't think I've ever really talked to a drummer at length. Is that well, first of all, I guess one thing you learn is that you get to spend time and be mentored by brilliant players,
right.
But you also realize like maybe jazz isn't a great living.
That too. Sonny Rollins was very upset with me when I left and went and started playing, you know, the Rolling Stones. He was like, oh, I know you got to be, you know, you're going to be a rock star.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. But
you played with Rollins? With Sonny?
Yeah. In fact, I played with Sonny. I started playing with Sonny when I was about 18, 19 years old. And I worked with him off and on the rest of my life, basically. He just stopped playing only a few years ago. And
well,
I played with him right up until that point.
Right. And in jazz, like, I guess the question I was about to ask is, like, you know, once you learn the basics, you know, what are these, you know, tidbits of wisdom that you gain from these masters? Like, you know, like, I mean, I know with guitar, you know, like, I can go over and Jimmy Vivino will show me a lick and mm-hmm. like, and I'll just work with it for a year. Like, you know,
right,
he'll
sure.
show me two blues licks and I'm right. like, oh, that's how you get to that other thing.
Right. Sure.
And that's that. I mean, is it the same with drums?
You try to work out a vocabulary of stuff that you can go to for sure.
Yeah.
But the main thing, well, most, great jazz musicians, most leaders, they want it to feel good. They don't want somebody to just play a bunch of extraneous stuff.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So my relationship with Sonny in particular is he enjoyed my groove, so to speak.
Yeah.
In my pocket, as you would say.
Right.
And because, you see, Sonny Rollins is from the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And my roots are Caribbean as well. And he... You know, he's written the most famous calypso ever, St. Thomas.
Yeah.
So his go-to thing is a calypso.
Yeah.
No matter all the great jazz and everything that he has been responsible for.
Yeah.
And all this brilliant stuff, his go-to thing is a down-home calypso.
Yeah.
And
that's a rhythm.
And that is a rhythm. And that is a kind of, and these, calypso tunes are very, they're melodic, they're fun,
yeah,
and they bring up tempo high spirits,
yeah, yeah,
into your soul,
right?
And that's his root, you
that's
know,
the calypso that delivery system,
yeah, yeah.
Up tempo high spirits into your soul. What does calypso do?
Yeah.
Oh, well, they,
yeah,
if
well,
you
they,
need
boom.
up tempo, yeah, high, yeah, spirits,
exactly,
in your soul,
and you dance,
yeah,
you know, and makes you dance.
What is that beat? What it Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's, yeah, at the root of him.
That's him.
So, like, if you were, if you know, if you guys were working out some shit, he would say, like, you know, pop that up a little bit.
Well, when,
like,
when we would play calypso during a show, and usually it's toward the end of the show because it kind of has that finale feeling and you,
yeah,
get the crowd into it after he's played all this incredible stuff all night and,
yeah,
people,
yeah,
trying to figure it out and everything.
Yeah, like what then, just
then,
happened?
Yeah, exactly. And then he gets into playing one of his great calypsos. And I would think of it as almost like the hip hop section of the concert, where it was I'm going to lay this Calypso beat down, and he's going to play forever, and we're going to get the crowd going, and the people will be standing and dancing and freaking out.
Yeah.
At a Sonny Rollins concert.
Right, because now they can like get out of their
heads. They can get out of their heads and just get into the rhythm. Exactly.
Like, you know, they've sweat through the first hour.
Yeah. Exactly, trying to figure out taking notes. You know, what happened there?
Then you just kick in with a Calypso beat. They're like, oh, thank God.
Thank you.
Exactly. But that's an important part about, you know, show business. It's sort of like you want to close strong.
Yeah, there you go.
You want them to leave dancing, not going like, I don't know what just happened. Yeah,
exactly. My brain hurts.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, they got way out there.
What happened? I don't know if I can stand that again.
Yeah, because I listen to like sometimes I got it. Now, see, now I'm going to go listen to Rollins, and I'm fortunate that I have like a handful of Rollins records in there that I have not paid proper attention to because I didn't know this key bit of information. Absolutely. So now I go in there with the Calypso information and the, you know, the up-tempo, you know, elevating the soul business, and now I'm going to look through that prism.
Right.
And I'm going to see
it. And you know, so Max Rhodes plays drums on St. Thomas.
Yeah.
Which is basically the most famous Calypso ever written. But he's not really playing a Calypso beat. He's playing more like almost like a Latin-y type of beat.
Yeah.
It's not a real Caribbean type of Calypso. You know?
Right.
So if you want to hear some real Calypso stuff, you have to, you know, dig into that.
Like,
you know,
who?
Like the Mighty Sparrow.
Okay.
Know, and stuff. You know,
yeah, that's it?
Yeah.
I'll just be flying around?
Yeah, exactly.
It'll take me out?
Yeah.
So what does it, because like your groove, your pocket, if I recall correctly, in whatever my first experience of watching you play was, it has a lot to do with the snare,
right? That was the loudest thing on television, that's for sure. Yeah. I used to carry the snare drum around with me too.
Yeah.
There was a drum that was made for me. It's very funny. A friend of mine, Danny Gottlieb, who's most famous for playing with the Pat Metheny group.
Oh, yeah. I missed the whole Metheny thing.
Yeah. So he played with Pat
I have a
Metheny.
Problem with fusion. I'll put it right out there.
Right. Well, that wasn't really fusion. That was kind of, that was post-fusion, thank goodness.
Well, it seemed a little soft to me for some
reason.
Well,
yeah. That was like kind of eerie, spacier kind of thing, even though there were changes involved. But there was more breathing room in there. And so anyway, at a party, I was having a birthday party, and Danny said, if you had your ultimate snare drum, what would it be? And I just made up some stuff, you know, 15 plies of this and 8 coats of polyurethane over here. And he had the drum made for me. And it was made by Joe McSweeney for a boutique drum company called Ames Drums out of Massachusetts. And it was a powerhouse, the snare drum. It was a tank, exactly. It was a tank. And so for a couple of years.
I didn't read it wrong.
No, you did not. And for a couple of years, I carried that drum around with me. You know, I didn't even take clothing. I just have a freaking snare drum case.
The magic drum.
Yeah. You know, a lot of drummers, you know, they have a cymbal bag. You know, I didn't do a cymbal. No, just the snare drum. And so that's what you heard on the Letterman show.
Yeah.
And I would, you know, go. So when we started doing Letterman, my first experience of playing live television was, you know, I was in the original Saturday Night Live band. I was the second drummer in that band. The first drummer was a guy named Daoud Shaw. I was the second drummer. I came in
76?
I came in 77 with Bill Murray, the third season.
Yeah, yeah.
And
But you'd already been recording before that.
I started recording maybe just a couple of years earlier.
With jazz?
Actually, my first recording session was with basically half of Wonderlove, Stevie Wonder's group. It was with Michael Cimbello, Nathan Watts, who had just gotten a job with Stevie.
Yeah.
Carlos Alomar, who,
the guitar player,
David
How's
Bowie.
How's he doing? Is he
doing
around?
Great.
He's
doing
a
great.
Wizard. He's a wizard.
Yeah, Carlos and his wife, Robin Clark, you know, the great singer. And, and, you know, part of the reason why Bowie went R&B, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, Carlos.
Carlos was on the
he co-wrote Fame.
Okay, so that was his previous to Let's Dance. I remember seeing Carlos.
Oh, way before Let's Dance. I mean, Carlos is, you know, Young Americans and all that stuff.
You know,
all
that stuff. Stevie Ray, I think, played on Let's Dance.
Yes, he did. Yeah. Yes, he did.
Odd pairing.
Yeah, unbelievable playing.
Oh, God.
What a solo. Yeah. I mean, that was, you know.
On Let's Dance?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing.
Incredible. So that was my first session. Yeah.
With Stevie or no Stevie?
No Stevie. It was with a guy who played a saxophone with Stevie, who took Trevor Lawrence's place, actually, a guy named Danny Morales, and he put together. So my first session was in Studio B at Electric Lady.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that's my very first recording session.
That's the Magic Studio?
And it's the Magic Studio, and it's a going in there, and I thought, okay, this is what I want to be doing.
And spaces are magic, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, you go to Abbey Road, you go to Capitol, you go to Royal Studios in Memphis, you go to visit 2120 in Chicago, you know, there are places, you know, even like in New York right now, if you're not going to Avatar, which used to be Power Station, you can go to Brooklyn Recording and Brooklyn Great and those, Recording those, Studio or Germano Studios in
they
New
hold
York.
The space, they hold the ghosts, right? You know,
and they
you
hold the ghost, and there's something, you know, the environment is there, and especially, well, you're talking about holding the ghost, Royal Studios is.
And that's where you did the new Robert Cray record?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And
was that a Stax outlet?
No, it was High Records.
Yeah.
That's where Willie Mitchell, that was his studio. And he developed the you know, he tuned that room. It was an old movie theater.
Okay.
And much like the original Stax was a movie theater. And he built that room and tuned it every day, meaning just tweaking every corner of it.
Oh, yeah.
Putting up wool hair and, you know.
And it's still all there?
It's still all there, you know, augmented by several cobwebs and corners and stuff.
Oh, really?
Which we don't touch.
Yeah. No, you can't.
And it's an amazing. Oh, that's the only place in the world that sounds like that.
No shit.
You know, and. Yeah, there's a lot of great studios still around, you know, Blackbird Studios in Nashville, you know, great studio. But there are certain studios that have a thing that only that studio has.
You can only get that sound there.
You can try, a lot of people try it, and you can.
Sure, there's people around. Like, you can do it on the computer.
Let's not go there.
You can't.
You know.
So, so, all right, so you did a little recording before, and then you're in the second wave of the SNL band, which is the Blues Brothers band. It's Lou Marine,
Lou Bones, you know, the whole thing. So the reason why I brought it up is because when I first walked in there, there were two mics on the drums.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, one of the 57 and a kick drum and a 57 overhead, not even a snare drum mic. I had to lobby to get a snare drum mic. You know, that's
another 57?
Yeah, they couldn't throw exactly.
$100?
Another 57. And the engineer was a guy named Bob Lifton, who like started with Milton Berle. You know what I mean? And so when the first day I go into to do Letterman, and I walk in, and they're like all the drums are mic'd with Sennheiser 421s and it's an RE20 on the bass drum. I'm going, holy cow, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And there was an engineer, her name was Pam Gibson.
Yeah.
Or her name is Pam Gibson.
Yeah.
And she was the one that got that great sound. And it had never been done on television before, where drums were actually mic'd like they were in a recording studio. So that is why that four-piece band, besides the fact that we were already a band, sounded so good.
Yeah.
And so now, couple that with this you know, tank of a snare drum, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so that's all you heard, basically, go pow, you know? Yeah. And you know, so every night, you know, between the dreadlocks and the snare drum,
you were there.
It was good.
I remember, man.
It was good.
I remember Hiram, too.
Yeah, absolutely. No shoes.
Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah. It was a great band, you know, watching that show. And just the juxtaposition between you cats and Letterman, you know, who played this kind of like, you know, kind of cranky broadcaster fella.
Yeah.
It was groundbreaking.
Yeah.
But you were on that. You did the SNL stuff. So you backed everybody, you know, at different points who came through the show. But you were also in that Blues Brothers band.
Right.
But were you in the movie?
No, I did not do the film.
Who's drummer on that?
the drummer who Willie Hall, the great Willie Hall, who played drums on Shaft.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he took my place. I didn't do it. The 24th Street Band, we had our first offer to play in Japan.
You, Will, and Hiram?
Yes, with Cliff Carter.
And that was all music? It was no singing?
There was singing. Oh. We were all singers.
Okay.
And we were like the East Coast Toto without the songs.
Oh, boy.
Without the
songs. Nothing, you know, nothing good about what you just said. Yeah.
No, you know, but David Page, you're so bad. David Page, you know, I mean, you know, those guys played, Jeff Porcaro, they played on a lot of great records, and they were a great rhythm section, the way Jeff Porcaro played on the Steely Dan records and Boss Gags and all that stuff. And so they played, they were the backbone of a lot of records coming out of L.A. that were good.
Yeah.
And then when Toto came out, you know, they basically took that thing and then they did the thing. So we were playing on a lot of records ourselves, but we didn't have the hits. We didn't write the hits.
Right.
So anyway.
But you had a following? You could play.
We did have a following and we played. So we were big in Japan.
Sure.
So we had a tour booked and the Blues Brothers movie was booked. Now, you know, in film, as you may or may not know, everything takes eight times as long and everything is blah blah blah. So we had a tour and I could have done the tour and then been on the set and it would have been fine, but the producer said no, everybody has to be on the set at the same time. It was completely ridiculous, and I felt it was more important for me to do this tour because I was in a real band and I really wanted it to happen.
So
John was a little upset with me. But I had a conversation with Dan Aykroyd the night before I made the final decision, and he understood that I wanted to pursue
own career.
Yeah, exactly.
As opposed to, you know, this half comedy, half, you know.
Well, you know, I have the original script, which is nothing like the actual.
Is that true? Is it better or worse?
Yeah, it's better. It's more clever. Danny is a very smart.
Yeah.
Person,
well, that was what was interesting about the record, and also not so, I guess, the movie, but was that, you know, they developed this comedic duo, but you guys played real shit.
Here's the difference, and this was part of the frustration. When we cut Briefcase Full of Blues,
it's a good record.
It's wonderful, and we have legendary players.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And
Matt Guitar Murphy.
Yeah. When we played, the energy was unbelievable. When we did that first record, we were playing the Universal Amphitheater before there was a roof on it.
Yeah.
And we were sound checking. We were, you know, Bob Hope was complaining we were too loud. You know, the whole thing, because his house is right behind the amphitheater. And the energy was amazing. People didn't know what they were going to see. We were opening for Steve Martin, who was the hottest thing in entertainment at the time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you have this thing where you're going to see this Blues Brothers thing, but you don't really know what it's going to be. Now, we had played as the Blues Brothers on the last show of the season before.
Yeah.
So, the third season, we played Hey Bartender.
Like 77?
We played Hey Bartender and we with the Saturday Night Live band.
Yeah.
And I was in that band as well.
Right.
And then John put together the Blues Brothers band that summer.
Yeah.
And we recorded the album.
And he was serious about it.
He was very serious about it. He loved the blues. He befriended this guy, Curtis Salgado, who kind of showed him the ropes, played him all the music, and he just fell in love with it, and being from Chicago and the whole Chicago blues thing.
Yeah.
And it was pretty intense. So, you know, we did the record, and you know, the record came out and it went to number one in 7 weeks. We had a number one album.
Yeah.
And we were like platinum. And they're giving us like platinum records at the Radio and Records Convention. You know, it was unbelievable. So now the film and
so the 24th Street Band at that point.
Yeah. Well, I remember playing the record for Hiram, you know, and everything. And I was very excited. But anyway, so now we could still do the thing. But the film deal was signed before we made the record.
Yeah.
You know, it was the whole John Landis kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just different from my way of thinking. And I'm thinking, well, we made a real live record.
Yeah.
It's actually a good record.
A good record.
It's number one.
Yeah.
We should think about
the
music.
You did
your
job.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, the music does warrant something. I mean, it's helping
sure.
the life of this film. But the musicians got no respect. So basically, I opted to be
do
a
music.
Real musician.
Yeah.
And so I didn't do the film. Neither did Paul Schaefer, and neither did Tom Scott. We called ourselves the Triangle.
So you do that stuff with SNL. You do Letterman, and now like you work with Booker T too, right?
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's good. But then I remember you showing up on Talk Is Cheap because I'm like, God, it's the dude from the Letterman show. He's a great drummer. He's like the best. And now you're playing with Keith, and that record's a good record.
Yeah, it is.
It's a fucking great record, man.
Yeah.
Locked Away? Come on.
It's a beautiful song.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So how does that happen? Because I would assume that looking at what you're doing now and sort of like that part of your career, the relationship with Keith is a big deal. I mean, that was a big chunk of what you were doing.
Yeah, absolutely. That was another commitment. When I started leaving Letterman,
yeah.
I would take leaves of absence.
To do sessions.
You know, I spent a lot of time in Los Angeles, worked with Neil Young, Stevie Nicks.
Really?
Don Henley.
Oh, no
and
kidding.
And all that. And
doing what?
Playing on records and actually co-wrote a song on Henley's End of the Innocence album called Shangri-La. I wrote that with Danny Kortchmar.
And he's a drummer.
Oh, Henley. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Henley, a very underrated drummer.
You know, he's good,
and,
man.
And, of course, one of our most unbelievable singers ever, and great writer.
So you're doing you're in demand and you're working.
I'm working a lot.
What'd you do with Neil?
And we did a record called Landing on Water.
Mm-hmm.
That is his comeback rock album after he did a rockabilly thing and a country thing.
Oh, yeah.
And David Geffen was so upset with him because he thought he was signing like Neil Young.
Yeah.
And then he got this other thing.
I remember the rockabilly thing.
And he freaked out. But we did this record, Danny Kortchmar, Neil, and I as a trio, called Landing on Water, which is kind of has a serious cult following. And
I don't have that record.
Yeah,
and I talked to him about it.
It's pretty wild record.
And working with Neil, that's sort of like he's a genius in his own.
Incredible.
Like
incredible.
What kind of instruction or what was that dynamic like in terms of what you have to do to accommodate Neil Young?
I just had to be me.
Yeah.
You know, I play songs first and it's all about the feel, and we just got on right away because he's like a lot of these guys and gals are just like they're like one person bands.
Right.
You know, when you see Neil Young play solo or Bruce Springsteen solo or whatever, they're like a band.
Sure. And you know it could go on for a while with Neil.
And Bruce.
Yeah.
They could just play all night, you know what I mean? But no problem.
Yeah.
No problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so when I hooked up with Keith, it was a weird thing. Going back to the Saturday Night Live days, I was doing the show that the Stones appeared on, which was the first show of the fourth season.
When they did Shattered and Beast of Burden?
Right.
Yeah.
And
the weird pants that Mick wore in the hat. Yeah. Like we were all kind of like, what's happening?
What's going on here?
Yeah.
So there was a lot of security, a lot of hoopla, trying to keep people away from the band. I wasn't interested because all I was interested in, the Yankees were in the American League Championship Series. And so I was just in the band dressing room, which was called the Departure Lounge. And I'm up there, I'm watching the game. I don't really care about what's going on down there. I could care less. And then all of a sudden, Charlie Watts, who wanted to find me, comes in the dressing room. And he said, "Oh, what are you doing?" You know, and I said, "I'm just watching a baseball game, and nobody's in the dressing room but me. That you know, everybody's trying to get close to
the
you know,
like,
I don't care." So I'm watching a game, and he sits down next to me, and so like I'm watching like the Yankees and I think the Royals or something, you know, with Charlie Watts, and he's trying to figure it out, and he goes, "Oh, it's like a combination of rounders and cricket." And so, yeah, I guess so. You know, And that's when we became friends.
Yeah.
So cut to like 84, 85, and I'm in Paris doing a record a Duran Duran offshoot band called Arcadia with Simon LeBond and Nick Rhodes.
Wow.
And so we're there. Yeah, exactly. So I'm there.
Gig's a gig,
yeah,
right?
Gig is a gig, right? So I'm there and I'm in Paris. I mean, you can't really go
right,
wrong.
Yeah.
So I'm there and, you know, road crews talk to each other a lot. You know, oh, we have the night off. Yeah, we're gonna, you know, so that crew knew that crew and the Stones were recording at Pathé Marconi, EMI. And so it was a full moon and one thing led to another, and Charlie invited me to the studio. So I
what album?
This was Dirty Work.
Yeah.
So they were doing pre-production to Dirty Work, which is the way they do pre-production. It's basically recording for any other unit,
right?
You know, but yeah, their whole pre-production thing is like, yeah, we're gonna go and record for a few weeks and then figure out what we have and then come back.
Right.
So it's winter. I get in a cab. I speak no French. The driver speaks no English. Takes me to the suburb of Paris. He dumps me. All the call boxes are broken. I'm freezing because I'm underdressed because I'm rock and roll, so I'm underdressed.
Yeah.
And I'm walking out there, and I think I'm going to get arrested for loitering or something.
Yeah,
you know, it's really bad.
Yeah.
I'm close to tears. And then I thought, I got to really hunker down here, and I start to listen to see if I can hear some music, and I just hear something faint in the background. I just follow the sounds, and I go down an alleyway, and I go up a street, and boom, lo and behold, I look up and it's EMI Pathé Marconi.
Yeah.
And the big glass doors. And I go up to and the door and I hear the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
And I just can't believe it. I knock on the glass and this little guy comes in. He goes, "Hello, monsieur." And I go, "Yeah, I'm here to see the Stones." And the guy opens the door and lets me in. I'm like, yeah, really high security. This is great. I walk in the control room and the Stones are playing. And they're set up like they're live. It's not like they're all sitting there. They're standing up. They're playing like it's a gig.
Yeah.
And I can't believe it.
Yeah.
And I'm crying. I just can't believe because I've never seen them play live. I mean, you know.
You ignored them on SNL. But
yeah,
now,
now I'm in tears.
Yeah.
And so now the song is over. They're, you know, they play for X amount of time. And it's like, yeah, go in. So I go in and everybody greets me. And it's just a wonderful thing. And that's when it all started. I started working with them. From that point on, I would go every other night. Ian Stewart would call me up and go, "The boys need you tonight." And I would go in because Mick would arrive every other night.
Yeah.
So on those off nights, I would go and I didn't want to play drums. Charlie said, "You know, play some drums." I said, "No, I'm not going to do that. If I'm, as a Stones fan, if I know that you're alive and some guy is playing the drums, I shoot that guy because it's like, why are you doing that?" So I played like percussion. I sang background. Sometimes I did some mock lead vocals for some songs.
Yeah.
And just, you know, and got to know them all. And that's when I first heard Keith sing in a lower register. There's a song on that album called Sleep Tonight.
Yeah.
"You gotta get some sleep tonight."
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, if I ever work with this guy, I'm gonna
get him down there. Yeah.
And which led to Make No Mistake. Make No Mistake.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
What a sound.
Yeah.
You know, different than the octave kind
of. Where you can hear all of the dark wisdom.
Right.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
What a mysterious, what a thing.
Right.
And so that's when I first heard that. And, you know, I think, you know, to myself, when I first saw them on the Ed Sullivan Show, little did I know that he'd end up like being like a big brother. You know, I mean,
I imagine that went both ways, though.
Yeah,
well, come on, Keith.
Sure. There's a lot of that. You know,
I can't imagine. Yeah, you know, the sort of like, you know, I mean, I talked to him, but it was like, I don't know. I thought it was a good interview, but it was just basically me grinning. You know, for an hour going, really? You know, but like,
he's a smart dude.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I've been a Stones fan my whole life. And then I read that fucking book. You know, you go through your whole life thinking like, this guy, he's a quintessential junkie guitar player. And then you read that book. You're like, oh, no,
smart man.
He knows a lot. He's like,
you know, we go to the Caribbean and we we'd be on the beach.
Yeah.
And we'd be reading like books.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, and he's like, he'd go to the beach with a freaking book the size of a, you know, a dictionary.
Yeah.
You know, that's what he's doing. Not like Yeah, with just, tons of drinks and chasing half asleep people, the whole whatever. Time. Yeah,
he's
like reading.
Well, I mean, his knowledge of music and like, you know, what's always interesting is that it's like he can, like he plays Keith Richards, but he can play other shit. Like, I mean, he can play, like, you know, but he plays the way Keith Richards plays. But right. if you say like, well, if he's like referring to Robert Johnson or something, he'll lay it out.
Absolutely.
He can do it. Yeah. But so like when you did Talk is Cheap, I mean, that you were writing with him.
Yeah, we were in the story goes that the first writing session that we did, we just went in and we started playing together.
Right.
Apparently we were in there for like 13 hours without a pee break.
You know? Right. Is that true? In.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's all hazy to me. I know that I joke about him cutting at least 5 years off of my life because of this smoking, secondhand smoke. I would leave working with him with a pain in my chest. Okay,
because
it's like
I'm looking at this at the songs and like I know this record really well.
Right,
like I listened to the shit out of this record because
right.
I was a big Stones guy, but I was a huge Keith guy, and I remember like is it Bootsy Collins on it, right?
Yeah,
on the first cut.
Yeah,
like I remember
big
that.
Enough. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Boom,
yeah.
Boom.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There you come in.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, with Bootsy, you know. There's like two lives of Bootsy. There's like the James Brown life, and then there's Bootsy's solo life, which is a whole different thing. Where he kind of became like the Jimi Hendrix of the bass.
He only took trains, I think, and buses, right? wasn't he afraid of flying?
Quite possibly. I know Aretha is, but you know. But I mean, the thing is, he would play with his, you know, when he played that stuff, you know, like Get Involved and Talking Loud and Saying Nothing, that kind of stuff with James Brown.
Yeah.
There's a certain style. And then, of course, when he joined Funkadelic.
Yeah.
And then he whipped out the thumb a la Larry Graham and he started playing that way. That's a different style of playing.
Yeah.
And so I said, okay, I said, we're going to get Bootsy to play on this thing. And he started to play and he was doing the second part two Bootsy.
Yeah.
I said, no. I want the other Bootsy.
James Brown
Bootsy. And he says to me, oh, you want the tiptoe funk, baby? I said, yeah, the tiptoe, you know. Yeah. You know, with the two fingers, you know. So, yeah. So he gave us the tiptoe.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. But that was the whole thing. Like, your first solo, you can do anything you want. We can get anyone you want. You know? And, there was a bit of concern of like what we were going to do. And we had, when Keith flew out to LA to sign the deal or whatever, to meet with the label, we happened to get together with Tom Waits.
Yeah.
That afternoon.
Yeah.
And Tom Waits played us he gave us a sneak preview of Frank's Wild Years. And he played that record for us and it blew my mind. It just completely blew my mind. And I said, okay, now I know.
Yeah, yeah.
We can make music.
Right.
We can go in and make music. We don't have to make, well, you're in the Stones. People are going to expect to hear something similar to that, which is what I was most terrified about because the Stones are the Stones.
Right.
You don't want to do
that. And they weren't getting along at that time?
They go in and out. You don't get between brothers. You know, they might fight amongst themselves, but if you get in there, then they kill you. You know what I mean?
Right, so right, you become the asshole.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. So, but yeah, so Frank's Wild Years was very inspirational.
Interesting.
Me.
Yeah,
and so
that's just because of the space.
No, just because of the songwriting, the sound, everything.
He really went out there,
and you know what is it's a big a story.
Yeah,
and. So I thought, okay, great. And it really freed my thinking up as far as going in with the approach of what we can do and what we can't do.
And that led to the Hail Hell Rock and Roll thing? And
well, that actually came out of that. But
oh, you did Talk as Cheap after that?
Yeah, I believe that's how it went.
But is that where you first, were you part of putting that band together?
Yes. I brought Keith to the Bottom Line to see... Joey Spampinato, the NRBQ, which was probably my favorite band at the time, and he played bass.
Yeah,
and we wanted somebody, a Willie Dixon type, somebody who understood that.
Yeah,
and Joey Spampinato understood that and played it, and Keith had never heard Joey play before, and so I took him to the Bottom Line, which is a club that no longer exists in New York. It's an NYU cafeteria something.
Yeah. And you got Johnny?
And then Keith's main thing was to get Johnny Johnson.
Yeah.
To turn the world on to Johnny Johnson, for Chuck to finally pay proper tribute to Johnny Johnson, and for us to experience what it's like to play with Johnny Johnson.
Yeah.
Because basically it was Johnny Johnson's trio that Chuck
hijacked. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, dealing with Chuck and Keith. Yeah, I got it.
Unbelievable.
You're lucky you lived through that one, huh?
Yeah, I'm telling you, it was close. I was a kind of I played referee.
Yeah.
You know?
Two hotheads.
Two very passionate people about what they do.
Oh, okay, that's a more diplomatic way of putting it.
Yeah, there you go. We had this guy working with us who thought of himself as a kind of a technical guru sound guy.
Right.
And so they rigged up this thing where they were going to control Chuck's sound from under the stage.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you know where this is going. So Chuck goes to the amp and it's not really doing anything.
Yeah.
Not good.
Yeah.
Okay. And so Chuck susses it out and freaks out.
Yeah.
You know, he just flips out, and rightfully so.
Like, you guys are going behind his back.
Going behind his back. This is a movie about him in his home.
Yeah.
And he's a co-producer of it, and now you're going to mess around with his sound. You're like, he's an idiot?
Yeah.
Not good, okay? And can you imagine the groundswell of, like, memories coming back of institutionalized racism and all kinds of stuff? Like, what do you think I am? I'm some freaking primitive idiot? You know, like, you don't think I know what I invented, this freaking thing?
Yeah.
The reason why you're over here is because of me.
Yeah.
And now you're going to do this?
Yeah.
I'm going to kill all of you.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what was coming out. And so Keith had to take the hit.
And there was a point there. Did he actually get hit by Chuck during that thing?
Or not during that thing, but the first time they met, he got hit. he got greeted. He's like, "How?"
Well, I guess that, you know, I imagine that Chuck, despite the respect he was getting, still the chip on the shoulder of those guys, like Little Richard and Chuck Berry, for creating the sound that so many people made such big money off of.
Totally.
That doesn't go away.
It doesn't go away. And Little Richard had a little bit of a softer disposition about it.
Yeah.
But Chuck, you know, they went after Chuck. Just do everything we can to stop you, pal.
There was a moment there where, I guess the real concern was that, you know, he played in these keys that were, you know, primarily piano keys.
Exactly.
And you guys were kind of, you know, just, you know, kind of, you know, moving him towards playing in more accessible keys. And there was a moment there where he wanted to change the key during the show.
During the show, yeah. After the guys had worked everything out in these other keys. Then, well, you know what happened? The backstory of that is that he did a show the weekend before the concert.
Yeah.
And he did the Ohio State Fair, in which he sang and lost his voice.
Uh-huh.
By the time we get to now filming, he's got no voice.
Yeah.
That's why he wanted to bring the key down on that song and all kinds of stuff. So there was, like, we had to actually, I mean, it's the movie is 30 years ago, so I can say it now. We had to actually dub a lot of the lead vocals on the film.
After?
Yeah.
With him. Oh, so he didn't have a problem with that.
He had to do it. He had some of the things he couldn't sing.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, for people who are actually there, they don't actually remember that he had very, you know,
weak
half
voice.
Of the voice.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you remember the experience.
Sure.
But we had to do a significant amount of fixing.
Yeah.
Because he blew his chops out on a freaking gig that he wasn't supposed to do, by the way.
Right. With a pickup band?
Of course. Well, that was the thing about this film, to Keith's credit, was Keith wanted to, besides get Johnny Johnson his props, he wanted to refamiliarize Chuck with his own genius and to show the world how brilliant these songs were. They're not all one big Chuck Berry medley.
Because
that's what he had turned everything into.
Right.
He had forgotten the brilliance of his own songs.
Right.
Because it was just like, can you do okay, yeah, great. And I'll sing all my lyrics all
yeah, yeah,
and whatever. And then if I like it, I'll give you $1,000 cash back. And
right.
That's
it's
it.
Like I'm Bruce Springsteen.
Get in the car.
When they put, we're pickup band for
right, exactly.
What are we playing?
Right.
Chuck Berry song.
Exactly. 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 Yeah.
Well, yeah, I thought you did a great job with it. I mean, I've watched it, you know, I've watched it several times. Cray, is that where you met Cray?
That's where we met Robert.
You know, it's weird thing about Robert Cray is that, you know, I don't know all his records, but he's one of those guys where, like, that guitar sound, man, that straight Strat, fucking, right. Oh, my God.
But besides his sound, which, you know.
He's a good singer.
He's a great singer.
Yeah.
He's not a good singer. He's a great singer. He's one of the best singers of our generation. That's number one. Number two, his playing style, what he is playing, is not anything that you've ever heard before. In other words, a lot of guitar players, you can, oh yeah, that's from Albert. Oh,
yeah,
that's from BB.
Sure. No, that's right.
That's what you don't get any of that in his playing.
And he takes the same space those guys did. He's not a noodler.
He's not a noodler. Every note he plays counts.
Yeah, he's got his own phrasing, which is rare.
A very unique phrasing, and nobody can do it, and it's incredible.
Yeah,
agreed. And it's wild. So the way he got in the band was, in 85, I'm down in Jamaica with Keith, and we're listening to stuff, and we're just getting to hang out and maybe do some writing or whatever. And
he likes it down there, huh?
Yeah, and I'm thinking that I'm going to hear the greatest reggae music and everything like that. And I hear this guitar, and I hear he's playing this cassette of some guy. And I'm going, who is this guy? You know, and it's Robert Cray.
Yeah.
All Keith was doing was listening to Robert Cray. Eric Clapton had turned Keith on to Cray, and they had the first two albums were two cassettes on the first two things that Robert ever did, and that's all he was listening to. I'm like, dude, are you gonna play anything else or what? You know, and that's it. So that's how I learned about Robert Cray. And then when we're putting the band together, then it was like, okay, we need another energy. You know, we had Johnny Johnson, Chuck Lavelle, Joey Spampinato. We needed another guitar player. Who was gonna be that person?
Yeah.
And we're like, Robert Cray, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, obviously you love him, and
yeah,
and like he's like a young Chuck Berry, the same age when Chuck came out, and you know, the whole thing, and he had that energy, and it was great.
And he did Brown Eyed Handsome Man.
Yes,
that's great, that song. Like, and he really made it his own, because like, he, you know, I know the Buddy Holly version of that too. Right?
Yeah, right.
Him, Buddy did
right,
it.
Right, yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, in Chuck's version, like, oh man, there's that box set, the Chuck box set, where you really look at all the shit he did, it's a lot of great songs, man.
A lot of great, he's a genius.
And like, I think he was essential to Bob Dylan too.
He is totally essential to Bob Dylan.
The turn of phrase,
you know, like Too Much Monkey Business.
That's it. And Can't Catch Me.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Monkey Business in particular is the bedrock of that thing.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Of Leopard Skin Pills, you know, Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat.
And Mediterranean.
Subterranean,
whatever.
Blues.
Homesick Blues.
Yeah.
Is
yeah.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely, man.
Yeah.
And you play with Clapton too?
Yeah.
What do you like him? You like playing with him?
Yeah, it was fun. You know, the band that I finally played, because we had talked about playing together over the years, but schedules never really worked out.
Yeah.
And, but we got together and we did a thing with Derek Trucks and Willie Weeks.
I talked to Derek.
You know, Billy Preston was alive at the time, and he was supposed to play, and he fell ill right before the tour, and he died while we were on tour.
Oh, man.
So my fantasy was to get Willie Weeks and Billy Preston back together and all that, and we ended up playing a lot of Derek and the Dominoes stuff, which I loved.
And
Megan and I are huge Derek and the Dominoes fans, so when the prospect came up of doing it, we thought, and Derek being in the band, we thought, oh man, this would be great. Well, yeah. Willie and then Derek and Billy, and you know.
You played with Dylan too?
Yeah.
And that was good? That was fun?
That was wild.
Yeah?
It was pretty crazy.
Why?
Because he was in this kind of, He was searching. Well, I guess he's always searching.
When was this?
But this was like, I don't even remember, like late 80s, early 90s, something like that.
Yeah, you toured with him?
I didn't do the tour. He asked me to put together a band for him.
For which record?
So it was, I had the honor of playing on his, I think I would call it his worst record. Down in the Groove or something.
Yeah.
You know that record?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm on there. And he wanted me to put together a band. So I put together this band. It was a little hotshot studio band that we could follow him, you know, like a SWAT team. You know, Danny Korchmar, Randy Jackson, and myself. And it became clear during the rehearsals that this wasn't going to really work. So I opted out.
Oh, yeah.
And then they... And that's when I think that's when the G.E. Smith era began.
Well, but your relationship with Cray, so you put out this new record. It's a great record.
Yeah.
It was nice to hear from him again. Yeah. And this is on your label?
Yes. Megan and I have a label called JV Records.
Megan's your...
Yeah, she's my way better half and great musician and songwriter. We have a band called The Verbs.
Yeah.
And we put our own records out on JV.
JV.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a classic old style label sound.
Exactly.
Yeah. It sounds like you guys been around since the 50s.
That's right. That's right. And so we were fortunate enough to have Missy Collazo at MRI Distribution partner up with us. And, you know, for me, at this stage of my career, when I'm making records, I like people to hear them. So I was not very happy about making records for bigger labels, and then if they're not really behind it, the record kind of gets lost.
Yeah.
So we knew, and nobody's really funding records the way they should.
Yeah.
They don't really take into account what it takes to make a good record.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the first thing people want to do is not pay the musicians or not.
Still.
I mean, you know, people are playing live again because you're not making any money from recording.
You got to go play live and sell those T-shirts.
Exactly. It's all about merchandising. Yeah. And, you know, for us, you know, for producers and writers, when we were the canaries in the coal mine. Our zeros started disappearing, you know, 20 years ago, you know, but now, like, nobody's making any money. And, you know, eventually some legislative action really has to take place for us to get... You know, for us to be able to really make a living again in the studio. You know, like Spotify and all these, you know, kind of streaming things is like, for instance, I equate it to this. Say if you were like Whole Foods, right?
Yeah,
and you gave out a card to people, say, hey, all you can eat for $10 a month.
Yeah. It'd be hard to get into Whole Foods.
Well, not only that, what would it do to the agriculture department and shipping and manufacturing all of, you could not sustain anything. There'd be nothing. Mm-hmm. You can't do it.
Right.
It's the same thing with music. You know, it's the same. All of those ingredients are the same. It takes, you have to cultivate, you have to grow the musicians. You have to maintain the studios.
Yeah.
You have to, you know.
You got
to
pay more for the organic musicians.
Absolutely. And for people who are actually really good.
Yeah.
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 The premium organic.
Yeah.
And it's the same exact thing.
Yeah.
And if people started to think of it that way, then maybe we would get somewhere as far as compensation goes.
Well, people are buying the records again a bit. Well, I'm buying vinyl records again.
Thank goodness. And there are new vinyl machines being developed and new plants coming up. And everything is cyclical, so we're not dead yet.
Yeah.
But we have to police the revenue stream of the internet where people get proper compensation.
Yeah, people have got to do their part and, you know, behave, you know, properly and do their part to support the musicians.
Look, if they knew, and that's why I use the analogy of the shopping for groceries analogy, because then it becomes clearer to people. Oh, because for them, it's a convenience. You know, they go, well, what's wrong with that? I can hear all your music. And it's easier for me to get it than I can listen to. Yeah, but we're not making a dime. You know,
it's fucking shame.
And so that's a problem.
Yeah.
That's a real problem. Somebody else made a lot of money making that deal.
It's always going to be those guys.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Well, the music business, I say, is the only business you can fail upward.
Yeah. Well, no, yeah. There's a lot of businesses on that side of it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Where the executive structure seems to, the primary incentive is like, who can I blame if this gets fucked?
Yeah, yeah. And then you're ruining the label. Why don't I give you, you ruin our company, I'm going to give you $20 million to get out.
Yeah.
And then 2 years later, they've been hired by another.
Yeah. I don't know what happened over there, but we heard you're good.
But we think, it reminds me of, remember when you were a kid and there were like baseball managers or basketball coaches that weren't very good, but they kept getting gigs?
Yeah.
And you go, well, how do these guys keep getting gigs?
Yeah.
Because they know how the system works.
Right, right.
They're easier to, instead of breaking somebody new in.
And they're also not a problem.
Right.
Like, you know, like they'll throw the fight.
Right. Yeah, exactly. There you go. I hadn't even thought of it that way, but yeah. Yeah.
Well, what's the new band called?
My band?
No,
the
High
Rhythm.
Yeah, High Rhythm.
High Rhythm.
So it's Robert Cray and High Rhythm.
Now, High Rhythm is the legendary rhythm section from Memphis that Willie Mitchell actually developed. The Hodges brothers, Leroy Hodges, Reverend Charles Hodges, Leroy Hodges, the bass player, Charles Hodges, organ and piano, Archie Turner, also known as Hubby, electric piano, clavinet. The late, great Teeny Hodges was the guitar player. You know, he wrote Love and Happiness and Take Me to the River and stuff like that. Willie Mitchell taught these guys how to play. He adopted them, actually. They were his adopted children. And as he was tuning his studio and developing this stuff, he also schooled these kids to play.
So he brought them back to their place.
They live in Memphis. They're alive and well. This is not a retro record, okay?
Yeah.
Let me be very clear.
It doesn't sound like it.
It's just like these guys still play great, and this is what we wanted. And Robert and I have been working together off and on since 98.
Yeah.
And the last couple records we did together, nobody really heard because for one reason or another, I'm not going to get into it, but like I didn't want to do another record like that where you pour your heart and soul into something and then nobody hears it.
Right.
So and Megan and I were discussing a way to go forward. We can't continue on this path of making these records for intermediate labels or big labels and them not supporting it. So it's time to, we know how it's got to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we just do it?
And these guys are still around.
And they're around. So one day it hit me. Robert Cray and High Rhythm. So I sent Robert an email. I got it. He was like, he was totally into it. And then we just moved forward. And Megan and I started listening to material and sending it to him. And he would, yeah, that's great. You know, boom, 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 whatever. And it just, the ball started rolling. And one key thing that we did was, I made sure that the band participated fully in the arrangements and everything. So it was a band.
Yeah.
It wasn't like we were hiring some sidemen.
Right.
Because that's not how it was done on those records.
Right.
Those great records that had full participation of all the musicians.
So it was an ensemble.
Yes.
And that's how you wrote and created it all.
That's basically how we created the tracks.
When was the last time these guys played in that hall?
They play there a lot.
Oh, they do.
They work out of there.
So that's their home.
That's their home. Absolutely.
Oh, cool. Well, I mean, I enjoyed the record. Now I know more about it. I'll go listen to it again with this all this new wisdom.
Good.
Good job, man. It was great talking to you.
It's great talking to you as well. Pleasure.
That was fun. We learned. We laughed. We talked about music. I wanted to say, because Steve wanted me to tell you. He forgot to mention the late Bob Cranshaw as someone who was a mentor to him. He was the first musician hired for the SNL band, and he took Steve under his wing. And sometimes you get talking and you forget to pay respect to the people you respect, and he wanted me to tell you that. And he wanted to make sure to let you know that guy was important to him. Pay a little tribute on this episode for Mr. Bob Cranshaw. All right, I'm sorry, I won't be loopy for long. I'm gonna play some Loopy Blues. People seem to be responding to the basics. Mm-hmm. Boomer lives! Hey folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.